Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, fellow slaves of the global plantation. The Vinnie Eastwood Show is bad news. It's like the news, but worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child-trafficking Satanists is Vinnie's jokes. And my very special guest today is the one, the only, the Right Honourable, Brenton Faithful. Brenton, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Vinnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. I get that a lot. Now, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about who you are and what it is you do. And you've been cast out of a side of your political party of late. So let's just sidestep that issue just a little bit here. Because there's a reason why people were actually interested with you in the first place, which would be your role as a funeral director during this whole health scare. But just before we get into that, I would like to remind people that the Vinnie Eastwood Show is a listener-supported broadcast, so please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, ladies and gentlemen, make a donation of $5 a week. Set up the automatic payments to support the long-running work that has been going on this show since 2008. And since the deplatforming and what have you, where we lost all 65,000 subscribers off of YouTube and various other terrible things happening, we really do need your support now more than ever. So that's the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Now let's get to our very special guest, Brenton Faithful. Brenton, thank you so much for coming on. Please give us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do. And bear in mind, we've got an hour. So, you know, when people say, I want to cut a long story short, that's not the show this is.
Okay. Thank you, Vinnie. Thanks for the opportunity to come on. So, as you have mentioned in the introduction, I am a funeral director and have been a funeral director for almost 42 years. Now, you're going to say, hey, you don't look that old. But I started after leaving university. It was my grandmother who actually saw an opportunity for me to be involved in funeral directing. She said, you've got the character, you've got the charisma to be a funeral director. And I said, do you know a funeral director? What do you know about funeral directing? She said, I know absolutely nothing. I just know. So I took my grandmother's wisdom and I approached a funeral director whom I used to live next door to when I lived in Wellington. I flew to Wellington, had a conversation with him. He by this stage had sold his business. But he was instrumental in setting up the school of funeral directing and the school of embalming. He'd been over to America in the 1960s and brought back the education, set up the school. So since 1971, the school in Wellington, which was the Central Institute of Technology, were teaching funeral directors. So he said, there's a lot of funeral directors owe me a favour or two around the country. I've helped every firm in New Zealand. So he said, well, you know, I'll get you a job. Now, as a young lad, it was hard because the job I applied for, the proprietor of the company said, we really, as much as you're enthusiastic, we really need someone with a little bit of life experience, let's say, because we're dealing mainly with elderly people and elderly people relate better to more senior people, so they were looking for someone. However, there was a larger number of sons who were coming through had done training at the Institute of Technology and Central Institute in Wellington, so it wasn't uncommon for younger people to be in there. However, I got work experience with this company. They gave me work experience. The vacancy was filled, but somebody had to sell their home that they'd given the job to. Turns out after 3 months, this person wrote back to the company and said, I'm sorry, I can't come to the job anymore. So that left an opening for me. I was doing work experience, unpaid work experience, and I felt a win-win for both the company and myself to now be in at the ground floor, sweeping the floors and doing everything a trainee funeral director would do, just assisting. So that's how I got into funeral directing. After 12 years experience, I decided it's time to open my own company now. Because I was able to do things that I could see that having your own company would allow you to do, because as an employee, there's certain things you couldn't do. So I saw an opportunity, saw an area that wasn't serviced by an incumbent funeral director, so took an opportunity to set up my own business. It's a big risk, because you've really got to have facilities that to operate from in order to make a difference, and sold up everything I owned in order to put my money into the funeral home and began renting a home again. So that's my career after 42 years. So it's 30 years in the business. I've met some wonderful people over this time, and I really can't wait to put out a book, actually, of my experience as a funeral director. It's, as I said, you meet some fascinating people, you meet some people you wish you hadn't met before, but you're covering every spectrum of society. Death comes to all who live, and we just don't know how or when it's going to happen. So sometimes it comes unexpectedly, and sometimes it comes slowly with leaden feet. But inevitably, death comes to all who live. So yeah, that's a little bit about my career. Me personally, I'm very community minded. As a funeral director, you get involved in as many things in the community as you can. I was selected by the Honourable Lockwood Smith to become a JP in 2009. Now he had only ever promoted two people through to be a Justice of the Peace. It's a role that an MP usually does, is to appoint JPs, and particularly if there's a shortage in the area that you live. And I think he saw merit. So after X number of years, he said, Brenton, I think you've got the qualities to be a fine JP. And I went through and did all my training to become a trainer of new JPs as well. So that's something very community-minded, helping people. As a Justice of the Peace, I got involved in school boards. I became a trustee on a new school development, the Ministry of Education. I got tapped on the shoulder and said, you'd be a fine person. At the time, I was president of the Lions Club, and also the master of a Freemasons Lodge as well. So it was a very busy time in my life, but I managed to along with the other trustees, get a school built in less than 8 months. It was incredible number of meetings we're having. So this is experience I've had. It's hobbies. I'm secretary of the Auckland Astronomical Society. I have just stepped down after 5 years of being the president of our local branch radio club. I'm the secretary now. I'm the secretary for the club. What else have I got? There's so many things that I'm involved with, I guess, in the community that I enjoy doing. Being a Rotarian for 15 years. All these things, of course, take time. I have four grown-up children, and I've got a little boy who is 19 months old, and my wife is pregnant with another baby along the way. So it's wonderful to be alive. Actually, it's wonderful to have a beautiful family and a supportive family too.
Mm. And after so many years of seeing so much death, it must be some kind of relief to start bringing new life into the world, eh?
It is. One of the saddest things is when a child dies, and it doesn't matter how old that child is, having to take the child, because usually a child dies, oh, we die expectedly or unexpectedly, if it's unexpected. Anyone has to go to the coroner for an autopsy, so the police become involved, they're the agents for the coroner. The last thing is you are taking that baby from the mother's arms and having to go for an autopsy. That's one of the saddest parts of the job, you know, the guttural call, moan of a lady who's just lost a child, you know, and I can really relate, having had children myself, how that must feel, but then I can't feel what other people feel. It's just too, it's devastating. And that's probably part of it. It takes a special person to be a funeral director as well. You've got to remain professional. You've got to remain aloof. You've got to just remain divorced from the situation. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do your job. You know, I always say, like, a surgeon, you know, it must be difficult to be a surgeon, or a nurse too, because it's so exclusive. But they just identify their role and divorce themselves from the situation, I guess, too. So if a surgeon's doing an operation, a nurse is assisting with the operation, that is a person they're looking after, but they're focused on the operation, not the emotions that are a part of it. But it's certainly an emotion-filled career. And you've got to have a good holiday every now and then to wring out the sponge of grief that you've absorbed from everybody. But again, as I said, it's a special person. If I didn't like doing it, I wouldn't do it. So after nearly 42 years, it's an incredible honour to have served the community that I've lived in.
Mm. Well, I think I have to share very similar feelings after being a talk radio show host and telling the truth and helping New Zealanders get their voices out to the international community for 15 years, you know, you, like that holiday. But yeah, man, you're talking to people on a show basis where they will tell you things which can be, you know, quite grief-stricken, but you've got to maintain your composure and just keep the conversation going, regardless of how it makes you feel. And I think that might be a relatively similar skill set. And I'm reminded of this story about Native American tribes. I think it was a northern, like a Canadian kind of thing. And they had this story where if a man would raise his voice above that of a clap of thunder to a child, there were these group of men that lived outside the village that would come in, grab him, and take him out into the snow, and he'd never be seen again. And there's a reason why these guys don't live in the village, right? There's no place for them there, because they're able to see things and they're able to do things which are basically hurtful to others, and they need to keep themselves separate to a large degree. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people who see the coal face of human suffering and grief and things of that nature. Sometimes we need to be alone.
Well, look, I can appreciate that. Having to raise your voice to a child means you're lacking in vocabulary. I think, you know, a child understands, a child is learning. This is what I'm finding with a little 19-month-old in our house now, that he is so aware of what's going on, both physically, emotionally, and we just talk to him as if he's an adult. He understands far more. He's not at a talking stage yet himself, but he can acknowledge, you know, he can run a sentence, two sentences by him. You know, I've got cold feet, I'd like my slippers, would you be able to go and get my slippers for me? And I'll talk to him in that tone, and he'll go and get the slippers and bring them back to me, you know. So they children understand a lot more. And I'm just trying to think of the saying, if a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. I can't remember the length of the poem, actually, but you're a product of your environment. I think nature, nurture, You learn a lot of skill sets from your parents. If your parents yell at you, you chances are you're going to be a yelling adult yourself when you become older and yell at your children. But children need rational parenting, and I think that's a lot of the reason we've got a lot of issues today in our society. Yeah, let's take a leaf out of that book from the North American Indians and live with your child and share the experience. Teach him, nurture him to love, to be a child of the universe. It's, you know, it's just to be yelled at is demoralizing to anybody. All it does is just switch off, so you don't have to hear that. And often with the yelling comes physical violence too, and that's certainly should be a no-no. Humans have been gifted the ability to converse language, and no matter how bright or dim you are, we've all got the ability to talk, and should be able to dialogue our way out of any situation.
Yeah, like Bruce Lee said, the best fight is the fight that doesn't happen, because you can talk your way out of it.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, indeed. So it's been a privilege. I'm not retired by any means. I just bought a beautiful lifestyle property out in the country, and we're going to grow our own food, solar power to run the house, and 20 chickens to give us eggs, and eggs for the neighbours too. So you know, it's a beautiful country that we live in New Zealand, and I can say it used to be better than it is now, but I don't know. We've got a few issues happening in the country now that need to be addressed as well.
I mean, such as the scumbaggery, you know.
Well, I think, we're talking about politics, I think the world of politics that's existed, you know, for a couple of centuries now, people develop this unusual sense of want to be in control. And people forget that the politicians are elected by us to rule over us, to represent us. You know, and also government is there to take care of us in terms of our safety with policing, to take care of our health with hospital, to take care of us with education, so we're learning. But we've seen such a shift, let's say in the last, I don't know, I'm thinking back, when did it all start happening? Predominantly, let's say 2 decades, there's been a massive shift away from let's even go back to after the Second World War. I think you could say there was an alignment. We've got the UN was created, which I thought was a wonderful thing, all United Nations all coming together to serve one purpose. But I just feel there's a different manifestation with the UN. It's got a different agenda than what it was portrayed to be.
The United Nations building was donated by the Rockefeller family, and the land that it was on used to be used as a slaughterhouse, and their first UN Secretary General was a former member of the Nazi High Command. That tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, well, I'm not worldly on the UN, but there's certainly a lot of things coming to light now, and certainly with the politics of the world, there's a lot of things coming to light now that these people aren't representing us. In fact, they're cunning, and it seems to be conniving, creating corporations and things, all without the people's knowledge. You know, and it's an interesting time in the history of humanity right now, and there's a lot of people who are objecting, and that's why I stood for a political party, which I felt was going to expose, I guess, the what was going on with governments. Now, to me, the government are out of control. I mean, we worked for it, we pay tax, and that's the slavery of working. We we pay our tax, but we've got no control on how that tax is paid. Every 3 years we elect the government, though, but it appears that it doesn't matter which government. Some governments, some political parties tend to spend more money than others, let's say, and others will try and get things correct again and stop the number of bureaucrats that there are, but there's just sheer waste. And most people go about their daily lives really unaware of what happens in the world of politics and the world of government. As long as they feel safe, as long as the government are providing for them, they really have no interest in every 3 years we get to have a vote. We think we're bringing in the party that appeals to the majority of people. MMP, I've never been a favour of MMP personally. I didn't vote for it. It was forced upon the German government afterwards, after the war, so the Nazi party could never take power again. Now, in Germany, MMP differs slightly than our MMP in the fact that the government, the political party that gets the most votes, gets to form the government, gets to form part of the government. What we saw in 2017 was not that at all. The party that got the most votes didn't get to form the government. It was actually second, third, and fourth. Now, can you imagine what would happen in the World Cup of rugby, for instance? Sorry, it's not the winning team. It's actually the second, third, and fourth teams that we're going to give the cup to because we felt they played better. It's a crazy situation, MMP. So I think maybe it's time for us to take a look. I know there's been a referendum on it, and people said, oh, I think, yeah, we'll keep the status quo, we'll keep it going. But I just don't feel it's the fairest method. I don't want to dive too deep into that politics. We've got MMP, and we'll probably have MMP for a while yet, unless something radical were to change. But politicians certainly know how to spend our money. And more, let's say, as well. And we've had a government over the last, well, the present government, and the government was a coalition previously, really knew how to spend money. So it's put us into huge debt as well. We had a prime minister who came aboard who didn't know the difference between GST and GDP and sort of smiled about it. I would like to see a government made of people who have been in business before. A lot of politicians come straight out of university, coming straight into the political arena, got no idea what happens in the real world. And unless you've been in business yourself, and you know the forecasts and the budgets and the profit and loss, New Zealand needs to be run. We've got a huge ability to export from New Zealand, but we're seeing our ability to export diminish with rules and regulations and permits and levies and things that have been forced upon. I'll talk about farmers, for instance, as well. You know, New Zealand was controlling 40% of the world trade in dairy products. We exported 95% of the milk products that were manufactured in New Zealand. Most of it went to China, but that's okay. China's a trading partner. We import from China. It's our biggest trading partner. We import, we export, and every country in the world needs to be able to export in order to grow its economy. What we're seeing is the eradication of farming. In fact, we're told if you follow the UN's Agenda 2030, they want to eliminate meat from our diets, dairy products from our diet by 2030, where possible, because we're being fooled into this emissions trading scheme that climate change is causing the planet to warm up. Well, I'll put my hat on as an astronomer and an observer of the planet as well. The planet's just fine. The planet is doing really well. It's not warming up. In fact, if anything, if it did warm up, my mangoes would grow better in my garden, to be honest. They grow quite well in the Pacific Islands. I was at a candidate's meeting, and one candidate said, if we went up 4 degrees, there'd be no bees. Well, I know in Niue they've got bees, and they don't have varroa in them, and they're producing honey, and it's a lot warmer in Niue than it is in Auckland. They've got bees over there, still producing honey. And I just think the misinformation on climate change is alarming. But, you know, the old story, follow the money. Why is climate change? Because you can tax. And I think that no matter how much tax you pay, it's not going to lower the temperature. We've seen that occur. The Congress in America are being asked, some of the Democrats are being asked, you know, $50 trillion in America. How much will that reduce the planet's temperature if we pay all this taxation? No, the reality is not. Humans only give off, man-made CO2 is only 3% of the CO2 in the atmosphere. The rest is what's called the carbon cycle, and we learned about that in biology in the fifth form, or fourth form science, the carbon cycle. The misnomer that carbon dioxide is a pollutant is very apparent. Carbon dioxide is necessary for life. It's a very, it's trace gas, really. 0.04% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide. 0.04, it's, you know, 0.04%. It's minuscule, and add a couple more zeros in terms of methane. The only observable place that we see the hothouse effect or hothouse gases is on Venus, which is completely shrouded in 400-mile thick layer of carbon dioxide. And the atmosphere of Venus is predominantly in CO2. So we're talking about 0.04 versus 98% CO2 on Venus. There's no comparison. Venus is a lot closer to the sun, of course, as well. Mercury, which doesn't have an atmosphere, it's too small for an atmosphere. It's one of the hottest yet coldest planets, like our moon. It doesn't rotate, and on the colder side, it is freezing cold because space is cold. The temperature of the planet is controlled by the sun. Perhaps a little bit of volcanic activity, but predominantly it's the sun. And the thing that traps the heat in is not CO2. CO2 is actually heavier than air. It doesn't float above us. It actually sinks down to sea level. Now we're told by some that it's causing acidity in the ocean and causing crab shells to dissolve. But that's actually not true. That's not true. So let's look back in history. We're told in the 70s we're going to run out of oil. We're told that the polar caps are going to melt over. I think at the moment, scientists are saying there's more ice in Antarctica than has ever been recorded. There's a hole in the ozone layer, it's going to destroy us. All that hole is gone. There's no reporting of that hole over the ozone layer. It actually has to do with Mount Erebus that was erupting when they first discovered it. Now, Mount Erebus isn't erupting, and the hole is gone. So a volcano will put out more ozone-depleting chemicals than all the fly sprays, you know, or the CFCs that have ever been produced in the history of the world, one volcano. So you've got to put things in perspective, and you've got to take out the sensation of things and get the facts. 98% of scientists agree with whoever's paying them. And let's face it, these scientists have been paid for by governments and universities to create this story.
And let's not forget that 98% of all statistics are made up.
Yeah. That is true. I think they can fool people with statistics. I mean, most people don't like maths as a subject and probably didn't do well in it still, you know, unless you are a brightest person. So statistics are very easy manipulated as well to make it in your favour or not. So let's just say 98% are made up.
So Mark Twain says there's three types of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics.
true indeed.
And with the climate change, you know, and Agenda 2030, I mean, there's so many things about how you live your life that it will affect if it comes into full implementation. You won't be eating meat, ladies and gentlemen. You'll be eating bugs. You won't be drinking milk, ladies and gentlemen. You'll be drinking soy milk. You know, there's so many things in your life that you just won't have no more. So we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. It's part of the plan. I'm guilty. Guilty, 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 guilty
To Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about what's going down. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very special guest, Brenton Faithful, is joining me today. And I would like to remind people that the VinnieEastwoodShow.com is a listener-supported broadcast, so please go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, make a nice generous donation there, ladies and gentlemen, and set up an automatic payment to support the ongoing work. Speaking of ongoing work, Billy TK's documentary screening roadshow is now on, and I'll be joining Billy as MC, and, well, I kind of do everything, don't I? You know, Billy can't just do it by himself, you know, that's just mean. And we'll give him help out there, ladies and gentlemen, and in Auckland and Northland, Rotorua and Whangarei, I think, as well. In the next couple of days, there are going to be some showings, so please go to that website, riveroflies.co.nz, to get the ticket times and whatnot sorted for yourself, or contact Ruakaka Resources at gmail.com. Rua, R-U-A, Kaka, K-A-K-A, Resources at gmail.com. That's Barbara Rasmussen. To get more further details on that. Now, back to my very special guest, Brenton Faithful. Brenton, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you discovered whilst you were a funeral director that kind of became a bit controversial?
Absolutely. Well, I think we're talking about the last 3 years, Eileen, I think. Mm. Is that what you're referring to? I remember reading on the parliamentary website there was a pandemic plan that was introduced by the previous party in June 2017, and it passed its third reading in August 2017, called a pandemic plan or an influenza plan, and it outlined everything that we needed to do in the case of a pandemic. And a pandemic means it affects more than one country, and a disease that affects more than one country. Now, the interesting thing was it rolled out in Australia about the same time. They brought in a pandemic plan. But interesting, after 2020, when we went into the state of lockdown, this plan was never referred to at all. So the opposition government at the time never actually spoke up and said, hey, we actually have a plan. But instead, our government decided to wait for orders from the WHO instead of, you know, implementing our own plan, which meant actually we closed our borders. If you read it, the document's about 180 pages long, and I did take the time to go and read it. It doesn't actually put us into a lockdown. I think there was another reason for that, which I'll go into shortly, but here we have a coronavirus, a novel coronavirus. Now, coronaviruses have been working for 40 years to try and provide some sort of cure for coronaviruses. Generally provide a common cold, or they can provide influenza as well, among other conditions. And they've never actually, because the coronavirus can mutate so rapidly, and you'll never isolate any sort of medication for something that can reproduce itself or manifest itself. This is the virus can change its form in order to become more successful. A virus generally doesn't kill its host as well. If the host dies with some other particular condition, bacterial pneumonia or something, generally is what killed. The virus is keen not to kill their host at all. So when this new virus came out, I jokingly said it seems to affect the elderly and the people who have a weak immune system. I wonder if they're trying to stop their pension from being paid, you know, just jokingly to a colleague. And it turns out that yeah, it was affecting old people, but not children. I remember having a discussion with my GP saying the interesting thing, it didn't affect children, this new virus that came out. And it must have been something within it that T cells that were stopping, children have T cells that adults don't have, so they've obviously got a natural immunity to it. Then we heard words like herd immunity, and the government didn't want to have herd immunity. Then some months later, it was revealed that there has to be some sort of antidote for this. I'm careful what I'm saying, because I don't want to be taken off the air, but we have to have some sort of methodology, and this very famous person who was invented computer software was involved. He's been involved as a Rotarian. He matched dollar for dollar for a eradication of polio in the world, and for every dollar that Rotary raised, he would put a dollar down towards it as well. But a lot of countries didn't want to have him there because of the number of adverse reactions that were happening to the administration of medication he was providing. But he came on and said that there's 171 labs working on a cure at the moment, and we'll pick probably about 7 or 8 of them. And this was a statement that was made, and it turns out that he made the statement because it's the ones that would be funded by his own corporation. So all the other laboratories really didn't have a show at creating it. There's a laboratory in Australia apparently said, we have a cure, but they were discounted. So the major pharmaceutical companies that were selected, one, I believe, had never made vaccines before. So traditionally a vaccine or medication would take 8-10 years through trials. You've got to try it on animals first, and then select numbers of people. And they call the phases in which this remedy, this medication is rolled out. But all those trials seem to not have happened. And so the experiment was the general population. So I watched with interest because our own government agency gave provisional assurance that this was okay based on the information that was given by the pharmaceutical companies to receive this. And it was a 6-month period that afterwards the pharmaceutical company had to provide our government with the necessary information. Well, that 6 months came and went, and there was still no information. Another month went by, came and went, still nothing. And on the 8th month, there was information provided, but they requested another extension. So there's another 9-month extension given to the pharmaceutical companies to experiment this trial medication on the people of New Zealand. Now, I looked carefully, it was going to be May 2024 when the experiment was over, May the 2nd, the trials would be over. So I just made a decision at that point. Okay, if this is an experiment, I'll wait for the outcome to decide whether I would receive this medication or not. And one of the things I observed after the introduction of the second, I think the initial trials, people, their life came to an unexpected end after receiving the initial trial, so they halved it. They halved the dose, but still gave you the second amount of 3 weeks later. Originally it was 6 weeks, and then brought to 3 weeks. So 3 weeks later, you received your second dose. But after the second bit of medication you received, I started noticing people pass away. Now, majority of people that die are elderly. They're in their 70s, 80s, 90s. So it was quite a subtle thing, really. But the interesting thing that I observed was the people had rolled their sleeves up within the last 2 weeks to receive this. Now, questioning the family, very subtle, first person was 98, but this fellow died really unexpectedly. He'd been to the doctor the day before and given a clean bill of health. You're not doing too bad for a 98-year-old. He'd walk every day, he'd swim every day, and this was August, so he was swimming, still swimming, and he passed away. And I said, hey, you don't think it was what he went to the doctor for yesterday, was it? He gave him he rolled his sleeve up, and they said, well, how will we know? You know, I said, well, I guess we won't, but let's leave it. Anyway, the following day, had another death, and they said, oh, this is really weird, because Mum just went to the doctor 2 days ago, and I said, oh, what did she go for? Oh, to get she rolled her sleeve up and had the medication. And I said, how was she before that? She said, really good. But you know, 2 days later, she's dead. So I just made a little mental note to myself, started keeping a tally. Now, the first 20 from that point, 19 people died within 2 weeks of receiving medication for the COVID. This is bizarre. This must be more than a coincidence. So I kept counting. Never revealed to the families, because I don't think people want to feel like they've been involved in some sort of experiment. So I just kept it to myself. And after 12 months, there it was. 95% of the people who had received a medication passed away within 2 weeks. And I spoke to another doctor who would belong to what they call the NZ Doctors SOS, Speaking Up for Science. He said, well, you know, each of these has batch numbers. Maybe the batch numbers where you live have been extremely potent or something, because where he lived in Wellington, he wasn't aware of the deaths that were occurring like we were occurring. Now, I gave a presentation. I was asked to give a presentation by a local freedom group locally. I didn't get paid for it. I just came along and offered to the public what I observed. And that was a full house. So they offered, they said, would you do a second one? So I did a third one in the same hall. And this is just the town where I live in. So we had three full house presentations, and each time there were over 200 people, 240 people, who were wanting an explanation, because their doctor wasn't sort of, they felt telling them the truth. A very good friend of mine is a GP. He is no longer a GP. He had a heart attack, and he's now on a pacemaker. He was trying to convince me the merits of having the medication. And I said to him, no, I'll wait, thanks. Anyway, he had a massive heart attack, and he's the same age as me, so he's had to retire early. And we've had a chat, and he said to me that the medical council is the only source of truth for the doctors. Don't take any notice from anyone else who might want to share something with you. Don't read anything other than what's provided to you. So I was able to share with him my concerns, and he went away from the conversation we had, which was over 3 hours, quite a changed person in terms of perhaps the medical council don't know everything. Now, part of the criteria I think our government signed with the pharmaceutical companies is there's to be no independent scrutiny of what the products were. I know in Italy the doctors were doing autopsies. That's where it started. In autopsies, they were finding unusual things like clots that were occurring in the body, and our doctors, our pathologists, didn't seem to be concerned about clots in the body. So I made an observation that these clots were occurring in patients that had been receiving the medication, and the ones who hadn't been receiving didn't have the clots. Now, some of these clots are quite long. A colleague of mine said he had one that was 800 millimeters, which means it goes down the entire length of the femoral artery down through your calf. That's where it's extracted from. I was in possession of a clot that was taken from a woman. It was at least 600 millimeters long, who was still alive, but she died later that night with a clot in her lung. So these clots are occurring. The process of how they occur was totally foreign. They're not a normal clot. They've been analyzed by independent laboratories. And finding the chemical composition of these are not like a normal blood clot. There's a complicated process that occurs with clotting, coagulation, fibrin, platelets, and all the different other factors that occur, Christmas tree factor and factor X and things that occur with clotting. But these are long and rubbery, and they can be quite short as well. I've seen a lot of little short ones, but it's only in people who haven't received the jab in their arm, let's say. So I saw Richard Looney, who was an English funeral director, speak out. Now, he's not an embalmer, but he was witnessing this. He was being in the mortuary when his embalmer was embalming. And there's another American, Richard Hirschman, who was a trade embalmer. Now, that's all he does all day is just embalm one body after another. He goes around visiting several funeral homes who may not have their own embalmer. Now, I began, when I first saw Richard and John speak out about these clots, and I couldn't concur, I couldn't see these. But our rollout, remember, was 6 months later, after England and after America. So after the 6 months is when I started seeing them. But I talked to colleagues as well and said, are you seeing these as well? And they said, yes, but we're not allowed to say anything. We're not allowed to speak out. So I belong to a group within New Zealand of funeral directors, and we call ourselves awake funeral directors. We're in communication all the time with each other of what we're seeing. And it's not only me, but only I have chosen to speak out. I've been attacked by the media, the mainstream media as well. The investigator even reported me as a justice of the peace for speaking out what they said was against the government. But the Minister of Justice at the time just replied back to the media to say that Brenton is entitled to his own opinion on anything as long as it doesn't interfere with his judicial duty as a justice of the peace. So I can't offer my opinion on anything whilst I'm serving a fine.
Indeed. Brenton, we'll have to come back in just a few moments here. We're coming to break. Last freaking segment coming up. This has been really eye-opening and I'm sure quite terrifying, ladies and gentlemen. So just keep your smiles on your face and we'll be right back.
Says the essence of Jewish power.
Dos, tres, cuatro.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Hey, Brenton. What's happening, man? Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, let's continue on with your little story there. Go right ahead, brother.
Yeah, just can't remember what we're up to just before the break. I think, observation of the clots. Now, it's not on everybody. It's not on everyone who's received the medication. It seems to be in about 50% of the people who received their medication. One lady spoke to me at a talk that I gave. I've probably done close to a dozen around the country now, all unpaid. So I'm not getting, there's no financial gain for me to speak out. I need to help my fellow man. One lady said that she received, rolled up, went to the doctor's surgeon, rolled up a sleeve and it was administered into her arm, and she went out to her car and put a cup on there, what we call a suction cup, and it's got a vacuum system available to it. And after 15 minutes, she said, out came this little white clot. She said it was about 4 millimeters about a quarter of an inch, just under a quarter of an inch wide, and about 20 millimeters long, which is just short of an inch long, came out of her arm. So this, whatever the process happened in her arm, virtually happened immediately. So there's a lot of scientists I know looking at the moment, looking for not only the composition, they know the composition of what these little white fibrous calamari clots are. They're looking for how the processes that the body is manufacturing these inside. And it appears to be something to do with the spike protein that's causing the body to manufacture these. They were called an amyloid protein, but I think scientists are more looking at the fact that they're not quite so protein, full of protein. They're something else that's occurring. Now, I know there's nanoparticles contained within the injection. There's all sorts of things that we don't even know about that are contained in there. In fact, the material safety data sheet that you get is completely blank to tell you what's inside them. But I know analysis has been done by independent laboratories, but our government has said there's no independent scrutiny allowed. And that's part of the contract that they had with the pharmaceutical companies. So it remains a mystery as to what these are. Doctors must be aware of it. In fact, I think the British Health Authority has just made a statement saying that long COVID is causing clots in people. Now, I've not had COVID myself. I've not received the medication. I've not been ill, but I've been in many, many places where the ward is apparently full of people. I have chosen predominantly not to wear a mask unless I actually have to through the whole process, through the lockdown period, because masks actually don't work. We were told that right from the start. Dr. Anthony Fauci told us, our own Dr. Ashley Bloomfield. What it to me is represented an outside of compliance with the government.
Indeed. One second, Brenton. We'll be right back after this short break, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, wait a second. That's the end of the show. Oh, mate. All right. Well, in that case, Brenton, where can people find you? Where can people email you?
Brenton, B-R-E-N-T-O-N, Brenton at Faithfuls, F-A-I-T-H, F-U-L-L-S, .co.nz. Brenton at faithfuls.co.nz. Thanks, Vinny.
Thank you, brother. Fastest hour in talk radio, ladies and gentlemen. Didn't get any faster than that. Please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. The Kiwi Bank and codes are
corporate
there on page 4.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion.